you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks a lot for inviting me to give this talk. So I'll give an overview of what we know about radio pulsars and globular clusters. I know that quite a few of you in the audience have seen versions of my talks on this stuff over the last 3 or 4 years. So there is some new stuff in here sprinkled out throughout to keep it hopefully moderately interesting for you guys. But most of it is kind of a basic review over what we know about pulsars and globular clusters, and there's a lot that's happened in the last several years. So what kind of pulsars are in globular clusters? And the answer is basically the vast majority, but not all, are millisecond pulsars. So this histogram shows the spin-free frequencies of the radio pulsars that have been discovered in globular clusters, and you can see there's this huge gap or huge peak there of the histogram. Oops, I didn't mean to do that. It's getting rid of that hand. All right. This huge peak around hundreds of hertz for the spin frequency of the pulsars. There is a pretty steep cutoff when you get towards 1 millisecond, because we don't know of any radio pulsars that spin that fast. And then there's also this long tail down to slow pulsars, including a 1 second pulsar that we're quite convinced is actually in a globular cluster. And these guys here, the ones that are, say, it's slower than 10 hertz, are kind of an issue for globular clusters, and I'll mention that in a later slide as to why that is. But we think we understand why there are lots of millisecond pulsars in globular clusters. And one of the main reasons why it's important that they're millisecond pulsars is that those pulsars last a long time. They have long lifetimes, meaning we believe billions to even tens of billions of years could be the active lifetime of radio pulsars. So once you turn them on, they're going to stay visible. Okay, so we could have created these radio pulsars basically any time in the age of the cluster, and they'll potentially be visible now still. Whereas these guys, we're not so sure about that. So for the millisecond pulsars, though, in the field, in the galactic disk, the way the very cartoonish picture of the way you form a millisecond pulsar, you have a supernova that creates a neutron star, or you have a companion star, some kind of main sequence star. Eventually, that main sequence star evolves, and because of stellar evolution, you transfer material into an accretion disk. In this stage, you have an active X-ray binary, a low-mass X-ray binary, and then eventually the accretion stops. The millisecond pulsar turns on, blows away, starts very slowly ablating away what is now a white dwarf companion, and you're left with a highly circular orbit with a millisecond pulsar and a white dwarf. This is the basic rough picture, rough cartoon of how you create millisecond pulsars. The reason why there's a huge number of millisecond pulsars in globular clusters, and that number, basically, there's about a factor of roughly 100 more millisecond pulsars in globular clusters per unit mass than there are on the disk. It's the same as the LMXB numbers that people were working in the 80s. The reason why is because in globular, is you have exchange interactions in globular clusters because of the stellar densities. So if you have a main sequence star, sequence star binary, somehow you have old, dead, boring neutron stars sitting that have mass segregated to the core, where all the stellar density is in the first place. You exchange neutron star in, kick one of those main sequence stars out, and now you just manage to get into this pipeline without having to survive a supernova with a core collapse star. And Natasha's talked about this yesterday. She mentioned a lot of different ways to get into this, to do this. But the bottom line is we inject neutron stars into binaries and then let evolution turn them into millisecond pulsars. So this is kind of the state of the field in one slide right now. The inset shows what's happened over the last 20 years. There was a burst of detections at the beginning when people first realized that millisecond pulsars existed, and then because of this thinking that there should be a lot in globular clusters. But then in 2000, there's a huge explosion of new work in the field. And recently it's been all green here, and that's the GBT. And there's various reasons for that I won't get into, but the Green Bank Telescope has really cleaned up. These are the globular clusters with the numbers of pulsars that are in each globular cluster. And you can see that there's a lot of pulsars with just a handful of pulsars, including many quite wimpy clusters, very low density, very low mass clusters that have, say, one or two pulsars when we look very, very deeply. But even some clusters where they're very massive, even with lots of density, we've yet to find any pulsars. So I would, even though there's now 26 clusters that have known pulsars and a huge number of clusters have been surveyed, I'd be very hesitant to try to state, you know, this is the type of cluster that we find pulsars in. We really can't make any kind of simple statement like that right now. Obviously, it does seem that the more massive clusters do have more pulsars, but that's about the only rough statement you can really say. On the other end of this diagram here, the cluster that's got all the pulsars, the huge number of pulsars is Tirzan 5. There's 33. 47 Tuck has 23. M28 just as of this year is now up to 12. Because we found one more this year. And M15 has 8. And basically there's a whole distribution in between. The ones that are green here, we haven't been able to get a huge amount of time on the GBT because this is a very time-consuming effort to do this. These are incredibly faint radio objects that sometimes just to get a 1 sigma or 2 sigma detection takes you 7 hours of telescope time. Because of that, it takes a lot of time. The clusters that we've concentrated on are the massive, dense clusters where we expect to find pulsars. So we've kind of been skimming the cream in the last few years. So you can see M28, which is a relatively, it's not too far away, but yet it's dense. And most of these other clusters are the bulge clusters, which have a lot of mass. And so those are the ones where we have been finding pulsars, but it's not necessarily because we've been doing everything uniformly. So I just want to make sure you understand there's a lot of selection effects there. Megasen is not there, even though people have looked at it quite deeply with Parkes. Unfortunately, Parkes in the southern hemisphere is the only big telescope that can see it. It doesn't have anywhere near the sensitivity as Arecibo or the Green Bank telescope, but no one has found anything in Megasen, and we don't understand why, because even some of these puny little clusters like M71 even M13, which are some other ones here? Anyways, there's several that are very low density and low mass. They have a couple pulsars. You know, why doesn't Omega Sen have a bunch of pulsars? Even though it's not very, very dense in the center of Omega Sen. But yeah, that's a very good question. All right. So some new stuff for those who have seen part of my talks the last couple of years. Here are three new binaries. I have a new student, Ryan Lynch, who's been working on globular cluster stuff. And for his thesis, he's going to be trying to figure out more of which clusters have pulsars and which don't. We found 6 in the last 2 years, 3 or 4 isolated pulsars, and then these 3 new binaries. These two guys here are both Black Widow type systems. These are, yesterday when Natasha gave her talk, she was talking about the ultra-compact systems and how we don't see anything like the millisecond pulsars in those very, very tight systems. These are as close as we're going to get in clusters to those. They have about 20 Jupiter mass companions in 5-hour orbits and several millisecond spin periods. And then this guy is what was just uncovered, and we just got the orbit a couple weeks ago, a 60-day orbit, which is very long for globular cluster millisecond pulsar systems in 6517. And there's now 5 pulsars in that cluster, and a year ago there were none. All right. The other big thing that's happened over the last several years is that we've finally gotten timing solutions for all of the pulsars in Tirzan 5, which has been a huge amount of effort. I want to thank Ingrid Stairs and Paulo Freire for a huge amount of work that went into this. It's really amazing to get timing solutions for all 33 pulsars because they're incredibly faint, and some of them have very, very tricky, nasty orbits. Here's an I-band image of Tirzan 5. Tirzan 5 is right in the galactic plane. There's about 7 magnitudes of visual extinction, but with timing, we can get these beautiful radio positions. Unfortunately, Tirzan 5 is very near the ecliptic, and the way I can't go into detail on how pulsar timing works, but it uses the Earth as it goes around the Sun in order to get the position very precisely. But because this thing is right near the ecliptic plane, we have very little leverage in the declination direction or ecliptic latitude. So these are kind of our worst case errors right now. They're probably an order of magnitude, maybe even better in declination now on average. But still, significantly sub-arc second positions for all 33 pulsars. Half the pulsars are on the back side of the cluster, and I'll explain how I can tell you that in just a slide or two. And then now, the amazing thing is that we have a long enough timing baseline now that we can connect a bunch of archival data together to get a 10-year timing baseline. And the longer your timing baseline is, the more neat information you can get out of these systems. But just to show you about the radio positions for TUR5, there's all the pulsars, the way they sit on the optic or in the I-band image. You can see most of them are centrally concentrated, although there's kind of this weird elongation, it seems like. And then there's been known integrated radio flux from imaging. And sure enough, the radio flux very, very nicely matches all the radio positions, showing us that, hey, there really are, all that radio flux is basically coming from millisecond pulsars. And the neat thing is if you add up, if you integrate up all that radio flux seen by imaging, you don't get all the flux that we see, or you get more flux than we see from the radio pulsations. There should be probably maybe another 30, 50, 100 pulsars in TURZAN 5. So advertisement for the SKA, that'll help. All right. So what else is new and interesting? I just showed you all those positions. Now that with this 10-year baseline, we're starting to be able to get some proper motion information. We in actually one direction in the right ascension, and actually more accurately, the ecliptic longitude direction, we're able to measure, we think, using an average of all these 30 pulsars that we can do good things with. The other three have really bad timing, which I won't explain right now. But proper motions of about three, did I just put that wrong? That should be milli-arc seconds. Sorry. Milli-arc seconds per year. Yeah, that's right there. It's wrong there. So minus 2 to minus 3 milli-arc seconds per year. Unfortunately, declination will probably not help. But I guess this would be really hard to do in the optical given 7 magnitudes of extinction. So what else can we get from these systems? Well, the pulsar accelerations, which is the spin down rate. The acceleration is p dot over p. And what you can see is that, so this is, we can measure this very precisely. We know the spin period very precisely. It's centered at roughly 0. And there's a handful of pulsars with very large values out here. These appear to be like young pulsars. We do not know really where those come from. They only have lifetimes of about 10 to the 7 years. But basically what's happening here is that the gravitational potential of the cluster is dramatically affecting what the apparent spin down rate. And that means we can't use these pulsars, for instance, for gravitational wave detection. But we can use the pulsars to tell us something about the cluster themselves. And Sterl Finney did a lot of work in the early 90s about this. Basically, the acceleration in the cluster provides a term, an acceleration term, as well as the galaxy's acceleration does the same thing. Proper motion provides another term, and then there's an intrinsic spin down term as well. And these are the approximate orders of magnitude of those. Usually the cluster dominates. That's why things were centered around 0 in that last histogram. But if we can somehow extract these values, we can constrain the mass to light ratio, the distance, maybe even the velocity dispersion for these clusters. So here's another new thing that we've just done for TURZAN 5, which I think is really cute. If you have another clock in the same pulsar system, you can measure the acceleration two ways, okay? Because we know that the spin down of the pulsar there's an intrinsic spin down of the pulsar that contaminates your cluster acceleration, if you want to think about it that way. But there's another clock, and that's the orbital period. And so if our pulsar timing is precise enough, that changes for its intrinsic orbital period changes are on much longer time scales, so there's much smaller. So that if you can measure that, that is the cluster acceleration. And we have done that now for three pulsars in TURZAN 5 that all have very shortish orbital periods, under 12 hours. And this is the acceleration measured by the orbital period. You can see the numbers there, certain times 10 to the minus 8. And if we look at what you measure from the spin down, this is the apparent spin acceleration, they're basically identical. But this number, the acceleration one, is always slightly more, slightly less in value than this one, because there's that intrinsic spin down. So if you subtract this one from this one, you get the true spin down of the pulsar, and you get the magnetic field strength, the spin down luminosity, and the age of the pulsars, and it shows that, hey, they're all normal millisecond pulsars. But this is kind of neat because it's a way of showing we can directly measure those cluster parameters and the cluster accelerations with two clocks in the same system. The other thing that's kind of neat is that because we've had these very long timing baselines, this is 10 years now, you can see these are the timing residuals. You can see this cubic trend that cubic trend is the second frequency derivative showing up. And once again, Stirl did work in the early 90s showing that the second frequency derivative can be related to the mean field mass density of the cluster, but it's also heavily contaminated by nearby stars. But we now have seven, and probably within the next year or two, we may have a dozen of these, so we might be able to get an average mean density of the very core of the cluster by looking at the ensemble of these pulsars and seeing these cubics. All right. The projected location of the pulsars is a log distribution here. They're very mass segregated, although there are a handful of outliers. One of the neat things is that when you're taking and timing these things, you can see mass segregation dramatically. Here's M28 with one guy way out there that's been ejected towards the outside. Okay. Using the radial distribution, this is kind of neat. Hopefully some of you guys can explain this. What I've done here, this is the cumulative radial distribution, but I've separated over 100 known pulsars that we have timing solutions into two different classes. One I call heavy binaries, where you have a neutron star and a companion that's, say, 0.3 or more solar masses. And then the red line is the isolated pulsars, or pulsars that have, like these black widow systems, that have much less than 0.1 solar mass companions. So these systems should be heavier than these systems. But when you look at the radial velocity, or the radial distributions, the blue systems are not mass segregated closer. They seem to be further out in the clusters than the lighter isolated systems. Why this is, I do not know, but it would be really nice if someone could explain that to me. All right, and then in the last couple minutes, I'll just show you some of the weirdo, wacky systems. I'll just go through these real quick. There's a whole bunch of different kind of binaries. I don't have time to go through this. Three of these guys appear to have main sequence companions. This is the fastest known millisecond pulsar, but it has this main sequence-like companion. It was almost certainly another exchange encounter that exchanged these in. These have very short orbital periods. They're all show up as X-ray sources. So here's Chandra images where all three of these guys are showing up. These time terribly. We see all sorts of tidal effects, but they're quite interesting systems for a bunch of other reasons. Using relativistic effects, if we have eccentric orbits for any of these pulsars, we can do neat things about the masses of the pulsars. And amazingly, because of these exchange encounters, we don't get perfectly circular white dwarf pulsar orbits all the time. Sometimes we get highly eccentric orbits, including we're now timing 11 highly eccentric binaries. That's unheard of in the galaxy. And so using this, we've got now relativistic parameters for basically all of them that constrains the total mass of the system, which if you use some statistics, this gives you a rough mass of the neutron stars. Green is kind of what we think this is kind of the canonical neutron star mass. Yellow is things that are getting interestingly high, and red is, whoa, these are really massive potential neutron stars. So things are interesting there. Here's six of them in Turzan 5. They're all highly eccentric. I won't go into any detail. But the neat thing is that these high mass neutron stars definitely constrain the equation of state of nuclear matter. So these are the equation of state lines, and this red line here is at 1.7. I'd be willing to bet big money, if someone wants to take me on, that at least one of all those I showed you are more than 1.7 solar masses. And that's very interesting, because already at 1.7, we're cutting out equations of state that, these black lines don't reach the red line, so therefore we're ruling out nuclear equations of state. And I think, since I'm almost out of time, that's just showing where we're getting another relativistic parameter for one of these. The last thing I'm going to show you, I won't even talk about that guy, is just this guy. So this is a total weird guy we don't understand. It looks like an isolated pulsar, except for the fact that in the same exact data, we're timing five pulsars, right? Because these are all in one beam of our cluster. All the other pulsars behave beautifully, except for this guy. Here's these incredible scattered timing residuals. Everything else is perfectly flat. So on these other two guys, these residuals, it's not some problem with the data. This pulsar just does not time well. There's all this extra jitter. Well, we think when we zoom in on that jitter, we see systematics. it looks very likely that this has got a system of maybe a couple or several Mars-ish mass planets. Now, unfortunately, it takes a huge amount of telescope time to get even a single one of these points. What we really need is a whole bunch of time just to beat this thing about every day for about 2 or 3 months to be able to trace out these nice systematics, and we haven't been able to do that yet. So all I can say is that it's very intriguing, but we don't have any other great details. So I think it could be planets, though. And this is my last slide, which basically I just want to say the potential for the future is huge, especially with the next generation of telescopes. Right now I want to make sure people understand we're completely sensitivity limited, so we've already skimmed the cream. You're not going to see any other Tirzan 5s or anything, I don't think, anytime soon until we get the next generation of radio telescopes out there. And I'll end there. Thanks.
Okay, questions?
Scott, can you say a little bit about your sensitivity to sub-millisecond? That was the big debate many years ago about whether you really aren't seeing them or they're really just not there.
Right. So we now have incredibly good sensitivity to sub-millisecond pulsars. I don't have a plot that shows it. There's one of these so-called black widow type systems has a 1.6 millisecond spin period. So it's one of the three or four fastest known pulsars. It has a pulse and an inner pulse that are separated by almost 180 degrees. And in our surveys, we routinely detect that pulsar, even though it's highly accelerated in its orbit and everything, blindly at the second harmonic, because it sees those as if it was a single peak. So that would be a 0.8 millisecond star. So. Yes.
For how many of these do you have dispersion measures?
All of them. Yeah, the dispersion measure is known very, very precisely. So that's actually one of the neat things I didn't talk about at all about the interstellar medium. That's another neat thing we can do is interstellar medium probes based on all these globular clusters.
I'm very interested in that because it's possible to map the ISM with dispersion measures of pulsars. That's the ionized gas.
Yes.
You can do the neutral gas through sodium D lines and red giants. And you can do the dust component through reddening maps of globular clusters.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so for Tirzan 5, for instance, there's a paper that's in prep. There's a conference proceedings that came out a year or two ago that we've done a very detailed kind of mapping across Tirzan 5 of the ionized gas. And we're now getting rotation measures because we're doing polarization now. And that gives you some neat information about the magnetic field in the galaxy as well.
Did I hear you well? You sounded like you actually do believe now that at least some of these young or apparently young pulsars really are in global clusters.
Yeah, I believe they're there.
Andrew Lyon wrote and some other people wrote a little paper many years ago already pointing out that if you just see one, they have such young ages, they must completely dominate the actual population. What the hell is going on?
That's right. I think that's right.
I thought Natasha might want to comment.
But this is what we've been discussing yesterday. I mean, almost all the neutron stars are produced through electron capture supernova, which goes all the time. So it's all right to have young pulsars. Well, the Mr. Lass is a subchannel of electron capture supernova.
Well, I was just going to simply say that I'm going to ask a pressure question and pass it back. But the point is then, if electron capture supernovae, at least some of the models say that there's just a certain mass ranges which are still quite massive, and therefore that's happening in the past. So if they're making them really very recently, then is it really just accretion onto a white dwarf, pushing it over and making it collapse to a neutron star?
Electron capture supernova is a general name for the mechanism, and accretion-induced collapse is a specific subchannel.
Okay. So just to clarify then, it really is
Of the young pulsars? I have not worked the numbers, but I think you're right. I mean, the important thing to know about radio pulsars is that the young radio pulsars only last, they're only visible for roughly 10 to the 7 years, okay? You can easily do the math when you divide, 10^9 or 10^10 by 10^7.
So. Yeah, so then you get a few hundred in the cluster. So it's possible, at least with very poor statistics right now, that you might make all your neutron stars this way.
That's right, yeah.
If you take a look at the dispersion measures, say for the 33 pulsars in M5, do you get approximately the same number?
Yes. So there's always a dispersion measure, distribution for each cluster, and roughly the delta DM for any cluster is maximally about 10%. So for Tirzan 5, for instance, the DM is in our canonical units 240, but there's a plus or minus of about 8 or so around that value. And so that 10% is the full width, basically, of that distribution.
And just to go on for a second, so if one of them were in the background, for example, you could tell, you think, from dispersion measure?
For only clusters that are outside of the plane. This has been done for 47 Tuck, and it's one of the only clusters you can do this because there's no contamination. You have a nice, smooth, galactic background in which to do these measurements. For instance, for Tirzan 5, the galactic differences are dramatically more than what would be ionized gas in the cluster itself, so it completely washes out any effect. So we cannot tell that for the vast majority of clusters, and only a very select clusters can we do that. And 47 Tuck is one.
I just had another comment on these possibly young pulsars. A two-part comment. One is that they're heavily concentrated, as Natasha showed in the paper, I think it was this past year, into the densest clusters, these really young ones, like 6440A, I think it is, right? The other thing is that there is a way of actually making these, if you just spin up, if you do something to a pulsar, and who knows exactly what it is, that spins it up just a little bit. So you have a pulsar that's born a long, long time ago and is spun down and is still a B of 10^12 Gauss or something. And then you do something which spins it up just a little bit and turns it on. And so then its B is still high, it's 10^11 Gauss or something like that, but it's only spun up to 1/10 of a second or something. You can do that kind of a thing and just kind of rejuvenate them just a little bit. Now, it's unclear as to what this is, but whatever it is happening in the densest clusters, one possibility is to actually smash them directly into a star, smash a neutron star into another star, which you might consider happening in the densest clusters. And most of the star will get blown away through the super Eddington flux, but that could give you a short period of intense.
The oldest neutron star that I know of 10^11 or 10^12 Gauss. So you can say that you want to have that there, but we've never seen that.
Yeah, A is.
Lars is saying in the field. But what about the Rosat dim isolated neutron stars? Those are. I mean, they're not billions of years old. They're
no. That's right.
But they're older than any active pulsar.
They're not 10^9 years old.
No.
Yeah, but your 10^9-year-old pulsar, if you don't do anything to it, will never be visible as a radio pulsar, right? If you never accrete onto it or anything, so you shouldn't ever see it.
No, that's true. They're going to be dead and completely invisible in the clusters unless you do something to it. That's right.
Any other question? Okay, Stein.
Not to act as a spoiler, but if you have a couple hundred pulsars and the characteristic age is about 10^9 years, there should be a couple that are 10^7 year old. And if there's a slight luminosity function weighting towards the younger pulsars being brighter, then you bias the distribution. And until somebody does a formal calculation comparing the birth rates of the young ones and the old ones, is a problem. This could just be a normal age distribution.
Yeah, well, I think, we don't see just one of these pulsars. I mean, we know of 140 pulsars, and we know of four or so that are young.
Right, but that only takes a little bit of a skew in the luminosity function towards young pulsars being brighter, which is not impossible. And since we're raising accretion-induced collapse, I can also say magnetic field growth. And you can... Come up with a completely different old channel to solve everything.
One comment. 7 magnitudes of extinction at V is less than 1 at 2 microns, and ground-based large telescopes with AO are well within the range of the proper motions you're talking about. So maybe you can get the deck component that way.
Yep.
Okay, so let's thank Scott again. Now, for the next talk, we had a cancellation last minute.